Our second reading this morning comes from the book of Job, chapter 38, verses 1 through 7, and chapter 40, verses 1 through 9. Please listen for God's word to you today. Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind. Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Gird up your loins like a man. I will question you, and you shall declare to me. Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me, if you have understanding. Who determined its measurements? Surely you know. Or who stretched out the line upon it? On what were its bases sunk? Or who laid its cornerstone? When the morning stars sang together and all the heavenly beings shouted for joy. And then the Lord said to Job, shall a fault finder contend with the Almighty? Anyone who argues with God must respond. Then Job answered the Lord, see, I am of small account. What shall I answer you? I lay my hand on my mouth. I have spoken once, and I will not answer twice, but will proceed no further. Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind, gird up your loins like a man. I will question you, and you declare to me, will you even put me in the wrong? Will you condemn me that you may be justified? Have you an arm like God? And can you thunder with a voice like this? When Steve and I got married, I relocated from Princeton, New Jersey, where I was doing my master's in divinity, to San Jose, California, where Steve was working and lived. Steve's job as a consultant required that he travel every week. I was just finishing a couple of classes for my master's program in absentia, so I did not work. Consequently, I was home alone in a strange place every day, where I knew nobody. After living in dormitories for years surrounded by people, I was lonely and I wanted companionship. After a few weeks, on the weekends when Steve came home, I would begin to chant, I want a little dog with a waggy tail who simply adores me. Now, Steve felt dogs were too much trouble, so every weekend when I chanted, I want a little dog with a waggy tail who simply adores me. He would respond, no. Until 8 weeks into our marriage on October the 17th of 1989, the day of the Loma Prieta earthquake. The Loma Prieta earthquake was a 6.9 quake, which was the largest earthquake to hit the San Francisco Bay Area since 1906. It was an earthquake that damaged the Bay Bridge, collapsed 2 miles of the Highway 280, killed 63 people, injured 4,000, and left 12,000 people homeless. Now, having been raised in Michigan, I knew what to do during a tornado, but I had no idea what to do during an earthquake. Indeed, initially, I didn't even realize it was an earthquake. But after watching the chandelier in the dining room begin to swing from side to side and the wall between the dining room and the kitchen begin to quiver and bend so that there was a sine wave vertically through the wall, I decided that my best course of action was to leave the house. I must say, in some ways, it was simultaneously an exhilarating experience, but also a rather horrifying experience. For our townhouse shook so violently that it threw me from one wall to the other as I tried to move through the hallway to get to the front door. After the earthquake subsided, which seemed a very long time, the phone rang. Steve was able to call from Iowa just before the power went out and the electricity, and the phones went out. Steve's voice didn't even get an opportunity to say hello before I growled, "Grounds for divorce." After a brief silence, Steve said, "Feeling abandoned and alone, are we?" "Yes," I responded. "Is it time for a little dog with a waggy tail who simply adores you?" The next weekend, we bought a puppy. She was a small English setter with white and all white with black and liver ticking and a black head with a brown mush and two brown dots over the top of her eyes. I focused all of my pre-maternal instincts and attention on this dog. Now, being a field dog, she required a lot of exercise. Initially, I would take her to a nearby field and let her run. She would run in a big loop around the field, coming back around within a few feet of me, and then she would run around again. When spring came, the wild mustard seeds sprang up in the field. And as it grew into a beautiful field of yellow, it got so tall that it became very difficult for me to see my dog and for my dog to see me. So as she ran, she'd go about 15 gallops, and then she would jump up on her hind legs with her chest up and her snout up in the air, and she'd look to see where I was. And I'd keep track of her when she popped out of the mustard seed field. But eventually, the mustard seed got so tall that even that didn't work. So we sought a new location. My husband suggested a place called Mission Peak, which was public land, hills around the bay, open grassland used for pasturing cows. I would take her up the hill past the cows, and I would take her leash off, and then I would say to her, "Heel." And she'd stay at my side. And then she'd start to pant, and I'd say, "Heel." And then she'd start to quiver, and I'd say, "Heel." And then I'd say, "Sit." I like to boss her around. And then I'd say, "Okay, go." And off she'd go at like a shot of lightning. And she'd do great big loops up over the hills, even bigger than the ones in the field, as long as she could hear me. And hear me whistle. I'll spare you. Don't want to damage anybody's hearing. Which was her signal to return to me. When she was about 6 months old, we took her to Yosemite. She was just an overgrown puppy. And we took her hiking along Merced River, which winds through the valley floor. Once again, I took the leash off, and I said, "Heel." And she started to pant. And I said, "Heel." And she started to quiver. And I said, "Sit." And so she sat. And I walked past her and said, "Stay." And then I turned and I said, "Okay, go." And she shot like an arrow and disappeared into the forest of the valley floor. After a few minutes, we realized we couldn't see her. So we called, and I whistled, "No kit dog." Steve and I continued to hike along the river, calling out through the forest and whistling into the silence. After about 15 minutes, we heard a blood curdling wail. It sounded like it was half dog and half human, hysterical and high-pitched and unrelenting. I instantly had visions of my precious puppy encountering some creature like a raccoon or a coyote or a bear or a mountain lion. Indeed, I had just read an article about a mountain lion jumping over somebody's fence in LA and carrying off their Yorkie. And the barking wail continued. Like a shot, I ran as fast as I could through the forest, leaping over large stones, bursting through clusters of bushes to rescue my puppy dog. As I approached a brightly lit opening in the forest, I could see my kit dog through the trees. There she was, in the midst of a small meadow, standing on her hind legs, chest up, snout pointed upward, barking hysterically. "Help me, help me, help me! I'm lost, I'm lost! I can't find you, I'm alone. I can't see you, I'm lost. Come and get me, help me, help me, help me." And it worked. I answered her call. For 2 weeks now, we have read about the trials and tribulations of Job. We read about how God allowed Satan to take away all that Job had, all of his flocks, all of his servants, all of his children, all of his material belongings, and even his health. We read about how Job's friends came to sympathize with him and to bring him comfort, and although they made a good start, they made a not-so-good finish, so that in the end, they brought him greater torment. We also read about how Job cries out to God, seeking an answer to the eternal why. But all Job hears is a divine silence and the accusatory voices of his friends. In response, Job is indignant. Job is angry. Job feels abandoned by God. Consequently, Job calls out demanding justice from God, saying, "Oh, that I knew where I might find him, that I might come even to his dwelling. I would lay my case before him and fill my mouth with arguments. I would learn what he would answer me and understand what he would say to me. Would he contend with me in the greatness of his power? No, he would give heed to me. There an upright person could reason with him, and I should be acquitted forever by my judge." It is like Job is caught in a whirlwind of torment. His friends accuse him. He defends himself, and he calls out to God. His friends accuse him, and he defends himself, and he calls out to God. Again and again and again, his friends accuse him, and he defends himself and calls out to God. Then one of his friends chastises him in anger. Job tastes bitterness in his soul. All that is meaningful, all that is worthwhile, all that is worth living for has been taken away from him, leaving him disconnected from his world. All his flocks, the sheep, the camels, the oxen, the donkeys, the animals that he cared for are gone. All of his servants who cared for him are gone. All of his children, the future generation for whom he would offer burnt offerings lest they cursed God in their own hearts, were gone. Even his health is gone. Everything that defined Job is gone. It is as though Job has died. It is as though Job has descended into Sheol, the place of the dead, that hollow deep beneath the earth where the good and the wicked share a common fate, that land of gloom and deep darkness which is devoid of presence, human or divine, that time of perpetual isolation when all relational identity is stripped away and all is solitary. Job already has the experience of Sheol, but it is just one step further, and he'll join the dead. For his isolation is complete. His wife shuns him, his relations shun him, his neighbors shun him, and he is alone. And still, God does not answer him. God does not respond to his pleas. Where is God? Finally, the divine silence breaks, and out of a whirlwind of torment, the Lord answers Job. The Lord answers Job, but I suspect that God's answer is not what Job wanted to hear. There is no divine explanation. There is no divine apology. There is no divine acquittal. No divine promise of restoration for which Job had hoped. Rather, God responds with a divine rebuke. Who is this that darkens my counsel with words without knowledge? Brace yourself like a man. I will question you, and you will answer me. Where were you when I laid the earth's foundation? Tell me, if you understand, who marked off its dimensions. Surely, you know. God even indulges in a bit of divine sarcasm. Surely, you know, for you are already, you have lived so many years. So what gives? God allows Satan to take everything that Job has, seemingly on a whim, and all God has to say is to rebuke Job. I can't help but think Job was rather disappointed by what he heard. I know I was when I read God's response. It was not what I expected. It was not what I wanted to hear. It was not what I had hoped for. Where is the comfort in this? Yeah, if we think about it, it would seem what God is telling Job is that Job is not really so very different from his friends. For Job, too, has bought into the belief that the upright prosper and the wicked are struck down. Consequently, Job wants to point out God's error in judgment so that God will then correct the error and give Job what he expects, give Job what he wants, give Job what he deserves. I think it turns out that what Job really wants is to be in control. Job wants a just world where if he does A, he gets B. If he does C, he gets D. If he doesn't do X, he doesn't get Y. That way, he can choose what he gets and what he does not get by choosing how to behave. Job wants to be in control of his own destiny. And God tells him, "You are not in control. I am." Job listens to God. Job listens to God and understands. Job understands that understanding is beyond his reach. Job understands, but do we understand? Do we who live in this technological age understand? We seek to grasp the truths of the universe with our science and our technology. And because of our technology, we do know a great deal today. We know that 4.54 billion years ago, the Earth was formed by the gradual accumulation of matter from the solar nebula, a disc-shaped cloud of gas and dust left over from the formation of our sun. We know that the Earth remained molten because of frequent collisions with other bodies, one of which likely created our moon. We know that over time, the Earth cooled, causing the formation of a solid crust, which allowed liquid water to collect on the surface of the Earth and form oceans. We know that between 3 and 3.5 billion years ago, the outermost layer of the Earth's crust broke into gigantic, titanic plates, which move ever so slowly, creating mountain ranges on land and deep rifts and valleys in the oceans, and causing the earth to quake violently when there is a sudden shift in these colliding plates. We know a great deal today. We know that when these tectonic plates shift, suddenly earthquakes result. We know this. But knowing it does not allow us to control it. After the earthquake, I thought to myself, the next time there's an earthquake, I'll make sure the kitchen cupboard is closed so my glasses don't fall out of the cupboard and break on the counter. The next time there's an earthquake, I'll make sure I'm not on the Bay Bridge or Highway 280. And then I realized I couldn't be prepared because you don't know when the earthquake is coming. At which point I called Steve and he flew me out to Iowa to take a break. Knowing what causes earthquakes does not save lives. It did not save the 230,000 lives lost in 2004 when an earthquake in the Indian Ocean caused an enormously destructive tsunami. All of our sophisticated knowledge may explain much of what we experience, may give us the power to reduce suffering, and may even give us the power to postpone death. It does not, however, give us the control that we desire over our lives and our world. Indeed, the pandemic has clearly reminded us of our lack of control. We are not God. We do not have control. We were not there to witness the beginning of creation. Indeed, we cannot begin to understand the great breadth and depth and immense detail of what God has done and continues to do in this universe. We know a lot, but in comparison to God, we understand very little. And in our search for understanding, we are in jeopardy of failing to understand the most important detail. When Job cries out to God from the midst of his whirlwind of torment, God, the God, who laid the foundations of the earth, who covered the earth with the deep oceans, who raised up the mountains and cut deep valleys. This God finally answers Job out of the whirlwind. It is this God who answers Job personally. Think about that for a minute. This creator who created our universe, which is itself so vast, that it is beyond our imagining. This creator who is called into being a universe of tremendous beauty and a seemingly infinite complexity. This creator God who called into being human beings who could appreciate the beauty of creation and whose minds could sense the hand of God behind it. This creator God answers Job. Answers Job personally. And the answer this creator God offers is not an explanatory answer to the eternal why of evil and suffering. Instead, this creator God offers his eternal presence, his divine presence. So God's answer to the eternal why is, you are not alone. How incredible is that?